Hey friends, welcome to Worry Less, Wag More. This is the Behavior Vets Podcast. I'm your host, Ferdy Yao. Join me to dive into the thrills and challenges of treating pet behavior issues. I'll shine a light on science-based training that's effective and brings us closer to understanding the animals we share our lives with. All right. Welcome, everybody. Today we have Michael Shikashio. He is a certified dog behavior consultant. He is the past president of the International Association of Animal Behavior Consultants. That's the IAABC. He provides private consultations working exclusively with dog aggression cases through his business, AggressiveDog.com. Michael is fully certified through the IAABC and is a full member of the Association of Professional Dog Trainers, the APDT. He also hosts the popular podcast show, The Bitey End of the Dog. It's a really great listen. He is sought after for his expert opinion by numerous media outlets, including the New York Times, the New York Post, Baltimore Sun, WebMD, Women's Health Magazine, Real Simple Magazine, Sirius XM Radio, The Chronicle of the Dog, and Steve Dale's Pet World. Michael is a featured speaker at conferences, universities, and seminars around the world, and offers a variety of workshops, webinars, and online courses on the topic of canine aggression, including the Aggression in Dogs Master Course. I've seen Michael in person at workshops, and I've seen his work online. And if you're a trainer or you have a dog with aggression issues, he is a great person, a great resource to follow and learn from. So, Michael, I really love to hear about how people became dog trainers. There are so many different routes. So could you tell us a little bit more about your journey in becoming a trainer specializing in aggression?
Sure. And thanks for having me. This is a really great opportunity. I started out, as many trainers have, kind of dabbling in fostering and rescue work. And I had a lot of rescues that I was fostering for, and I started to see more of the problem behaviors. As you know, if you start to foster dogs, the rescues start sending you the more difficult fosters just because they know you're experienced. And I wanted to really help these dogs because I saw a lot of them, or a lot of dogs in shelters or foster situations, taking a long time to be adopted out, or in some cases, being surrendered back to the shelter or euthanized for behavior issues. And one of the things I was seeing was that aggression being such a big a behavior issue in many dogs, is that it was one of the chief reasons for this owner surrender or behavioral euthanasia. So I thought, you know, what better way to help these dogs to learn as much as I could about working with aggression and behavior in general. So that sort of sparked my interest, and that's why I pursued aggression, because I found it fascinating, and I wanted to digest as much information as I could over the years. So that's how it kind of, one thing led to another. I started seeing clients and then going and taking more and more cases and going to full-time business and then starting to work with other trainers and to where I am now, just kind of mostly teaching other trainers how to help these dogs. And it's very rewarding for me because I know I'm able to reach a lot of people now with the platforms I've had. I'm very fortunate and lucky to be able to do that, but that's been my journey.
Wow, that's cool. So when you started fostering dogs, were you thinking about becoming a trainer then?
You know, that's a great question. I had always wanted to own a business, and at the time I was actually working at a casino, of all things. Complete career change for me, but yeah, I was nowhere in the animal training or, you know, behavior industry at all, but I always wanted to have a business. I always wanted to like have a restaurant, you know, when I was younger. And so I always had this passion for entrepreneurship and running a business. And so I thought at first, oh, let me learn about dogs. So I started, actually my original aspiration was to open a dog daycare. And that shifted more towards the training and behavior side, because opening a dog daycare requires some knowledge about behavior. And so once I started getting that behavior bug, that's when it really took off for me. So yeah, it's shifted quite a bit to where it is now.
Yeah, that's cool. So with all the different behavior issues that you might have encountered when you're fostering dogs, what is it about aggression that you were drawn to? Why did that become your specialty instead of, you know, just working with all types of different cases?
I don't really have a significant reason for it other than I really just loved it. I really loved the topic. I loved the discussions. I loved engaging in conversations online and with other trainers. This is when the old Yahoo groups were around, and yeah. We used to do a lot of discussion, and I just found it fascinating, you know, and that there really wasn't a whole lot of information, really a good science-based information on modifying aggression in dogs either at the time. So that's kind of just, again, sparked my fuel to just pursue this topic and focus on it specifically. I find that focusing on one issue also helps you become better at it faster rather than trying to just to kind of encompass everything, all the behavior issues like separation anxiety and compulsive behaviors. I find you can learn faster if you just focus on one thing. So all those other cases I refer out to other people and then just focus on the aggression stuff.
That's certainly true. I think it's great. I attend one of your workshops and how you were coaching trainers with defensive handling skills. It was something that was really sorely needed. And it was, I got a lot out of your workshop. Just watching you handle a leash, you know, just a simple act of doing that. And it's something that I hadn't really thought about all that much when I was working with my clients. And I felt that taking some of those skills that I learned from attending your workshop really helped build confidence in a lot of my clients in that, okay, here's something that I can really work on. And from there, that really helped kind of build more momentum in helping with other issues with the dog. So you must get some interesting reactions from people when you tell them about what you do, right? What are some of the more interesting reactions that you've gotten?
That's a really good question. It's something I've learned to actually avoid telling people what I do now. You know, so you go like to a place, you have spark up a conversation, they ask, okay, what do you do for a living? I just say, I run an online education company. I don't get into the topic because if you start talking about dog behavior, everybody's always got a story, and then they want to ask you questions. But yeah, it's I get all kinds of interesting reactions. You know, it's a lot of people just love when you tell them you're a dog trainer, or just right. I'm sure you get the same reactions, Ferdy, when you say that, and they're like, "Oh, you're so, that's really cool. And what is that like? And what about my dog?" They start asking you questions, of course. But when I tell them about aggression, it becomes more interesting. Then, of course, the questions are like, how many times have you been bitten? or are you scared of dogs? Or, some fascinating questions that come up. So, yeah. And so right now I've been trying to avoid that topic just if I'm in a rush, like at the bank or something,
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. How many times have you been bitten? Right. That's a question you get a lot. Do you get scared when you're walking into a case? And it can be, I feel like a lot of trainers who do this type of work, they're a bit of thrill seekers in the sense. How do you feel sometimes when you're walking into a case?
So I think it's important to have some level of concern to keep yourself safe. I don't think it's I think it's important to have, not going there being completely thinking you're bulletproof or like Superman. And it's certainly not a concept or something where we're going to be overconfident or feel like we can just take on any dog. It's always better to have that level of caution because safety is very something that's tantamount to what I teach other trainers, because the worst thing that can happen is us getting bitten, not only from our standpoint, but from the dog's standpoint, because now we're putting another dog bite on that dog's record. And it can really be impactful to the clients too. If their dog bites the trainer, my gosh, and the trainer's getting bitten. How's that? You know, that's the most awful circumstance in a lot of times, because if the trainer's getting bitten and the trainer supposedly knows how to handle these type of dogs, my dog's just going to bite anybody then. So it's really important to exercise safety, put those safety layers in place. And when you do so, when you have the right safety and management in place, you don't have to worry about the dog bites, because you've taken the precautions ahead of time to really mitigate any potential bites. So to answer your question, I'm not afraid, but I'm cautious, you know, and cautious for the sense of both my sake and also the dog's sake and the client's sake.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's that's a great way to put it. I think it's important to, I guess, model the calm behavior, right? And, you know, one thing I have noticed in my career in working with lots of other trainers and learning from other trainers is some of the best trainers I know, or really the best trainers know, are people who are able to somehow remain very calm while there could be all sorts of chaos going on around them, and just keep a level head. And I'm sure that's very important when you are working with a dog, with dogs that are exhibiting aggressive behavior, that you're not, you know, losing it, so to speak, and you're remaining calm.
Yeah, and I see that. I also find that when your safety setup, again, is correct, you know, most of the time we're trying to make the dogs as most comfortable as possible. So if we're setting things up correctly, we're not going to see any aggressive displays. Sometimes that's unavoidable. Sometimes, you know, you have to work or observe the dog or try to get some initial inroads with the dog, and the dog's going to come out barking and lunging and spitting on you. You know, and if, again, if you have the right safety setup, I worked with a German Shepherd just a couple months ago, and boy, that dog is, most people would not go anywhere near that dog. I mean, that dog was barking, lunging, snarling, but I had a tall chain link fence in front of me, as well as a what's called a back tie. It's when the dog is tethered to something to prevent it from actually jumping over the fence. So there's two layers of safety there. But I mean, the dog was barking and so ferociously at me. I'm covered with the dog spit from about 10 feet away. And so most people would just be like, whoa, that is very scary stuff. But when you have those layers of safety, you can just kind of stand there calmly. So after a few minutes of my usual treat tossing to this dog, went from that to going to being calm around me. And that's how I built my initial relationship with the dog. But it's all about that safety and management setup that can make all the difference in the world. Because if that dog wasn't on leash and didn't have the fence, then I'd be a little afraid.
Yeah, that is so true. I think that's a great point to stress to everybody, that safety management is so important in when you're working in cases like this. Okay, Michael, so I want to, as someone who specializes in treating aggressive behavior in dogs, I would like to really ask you more about one specific type of aggressive behavior, which is aggressive behavior directed towards other dogs, right? So I'm talking about, to be specific, I'm talking about dogs who growl, bark, and lunge at other dogs on leash, or dogs who will attack or even bite other dogs given the opportunity. You know, I really think this is an important topic because many owners, caretakers struggle with this issue. I'm a trainer who works in New York City, the Bronx, and in Westchester, which is one of the suburbs that's around New York City. And as you know, this can be a very challenging issue to manage in urban areas with lots of dogs and people who love dogs. So they want to take the dogs out with them everywhere. And then, you know, I want to get into this a little bit more, too. I also work at the Humane Society of Westchester in New Rochelle, and dog-directed aggression is one of the most important factors that we consider when we're attempting to safely place a dog. So what factors contribute to your, you know, overall prognosis of this behavior? Can you walk me through your approach when you're working with a client?
Sure. So I think it first thing to assess is why the dog is displaying that behavior in the first place. And there's different types of dog-dog aggression I'll deal with, or different types of cases, I should say. It might be dog-dog aggression in the home, so intra-household dog-dog aggression. It might be dog to other dogs outside the home, so on leash. It may be on leash only, maybe in certain environments, and might be in certain times in play groups or play situations where it spills over into aggression. So there's, I kind of want to first determine what the context or reason for the dog's behavior in the first place. And then, because the underlying motivation is very important to assess so that we're applying the right treatment plan. So let's say the dog's fighting in the home. Well, why are they fighting in the home? And one of the most common reasons is resources. You know, the dogs are competing over something in the home, whether it's food, toys, bones, resting spots, people. That's by far probably the most common reason I see dogs having issues with each other in the home. So outside the home, you might have a dog that's, for instance, barking and lunging at other dogs on leash. And then I have to assess, well, why is the dog doing that? How's the dog off leash? You know, so look at the variables of the environment and the context it happens. And then you also have to assess, well, maybe the dog is just frustrated and can't get to go see the other dog. So then we have to assess, you know, we call those sort of like frustrated greeters. So that's sort of a label for that. But we have to assess, is that the case? Or is it the dog's actually afraid of other dogs because maybe it's had a negative experience? So many of these cases, I really dig deep into the history or the historical data that the client gives me, because then I'm going to be able to unpack and unravel why the dog is displaying that behavior in the first place, and then apply the correct treatment plan, because the behavior plan is going to look much different for a dog that's frustrated because it can't get to see another dog, so it's barking and lunging on leash, versus a dog that's barking and lunging on leash because they want the other dog to go away. Mm-hmm. And past history will often dictate that, as well as body language and even possibly assessing it with other methods, like a decoy dog or something, to really determine what's going on. But that, to answer your question, that's kind of the I always have to take a step back to see what is going on in the case first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's take an example. Like you mentioned a good one, resource guarding or competing over resources in a home. Is this something that can be treated? Is this something that you help clients treat, or do you? Is this something more that you teach clients how to manage that situation more? How do you kind of come arrive at that decision?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when we're looking at, let's say, a case where the dogs are competing over resources, much depends on the severity factor. So things like the level of injuries the dogs might have inflicted to each other, the size difference of the dogs, the age difference. You know, if you have a large dog guarding small objects from a small dog, that can get dangerous for the small dog. Sometimes it can be the breed of dog. You know, you might have certain breeds that are more prone to guarding resources in the home. So severity of injuries, I mentioned, if you have dogs that are biting each other at higher levels, that's going to create a much more difficult scenario in terms of overall prognosis, risk, and management. And speaking of management, a lot depends on the client. So how much they can manage the behavior. If they have, you know, five dogs that are all fighting with each other over resources, that's going to be difficult to manage. And then if you add in, you know, they have five dogs and five kids, that's often a case where you might have considerations for not even being able to work through that case from a management or behavior change standpoint. But then there's plenty of cases, of course, that the owners might just choose management. And it can be as simple as, like, a client will contact me and say, well, my dog's fought over a bone. I brought this new bone home the other day and I put one in between them and they got in a fight over it. And I'll just ask them, well, have they fought over anything else? No, it was just this one bone. They've lived together for 7 years. I'll say, well, just don't give them the bone. And they're like, well, that's a great idea. Then they're done with it. So that's straight management kind of case. So you have lots of variations. And so I'll look at what's realistic for that particular client and what's realistic for their particular situation and what their overall goals are. And when you move into that stage of the discussion, the goals are highly dependent, again, on those variables. So we have to sometimes help them set realistic goals. If I have that client that says, well, they fought over a bone, can't they just share the same bone? I'll say, well, that's probably not a realistic goal, but a realistic goal might be saying, we can give them bones, we're just going to give them each one in their own space and separate them when they have them. Certainly a viable solution in that case. And that's a very simplistic example. Of course, most cases there's multiple factors going on, but assessing what is reasonable in that case. So if I have a client that the dogs have a history of fighting with severe injuries, and they want their dogs to, you know, get along, no fights ever again, and no worry about fighting, and just let them be able to live in the home together without any restrictions, there's a conversation that might need to be had about realistic expectations. And so it's not to say you can't work with those clients and make them make things much better. We just have to make sure that the expectations are realistic, or else we're going to set ourselves up for failure and the client up for failure, and what's the word I'm looking for? They're going to be kind of sad about it. Big technical word. They're sad about the outcome in the case if it doesn't work out the way they want it to. So, it's kind of, you kind of want to move through those variables, you know, with their assessment and goals, and then determining if management or training is viable in that case based on those factors I had mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. I think people are so disappointed sometimes when they think, oh, I can't just give them both bones and they can't just get along, and that they have to do things like, oh, I should put them either in their crates or put up a gate between them. It really is. People do get disappointed when they realize that, you mean we can't fix this? You know, is it really hard? Let's say there hasn't been a bite history. Like, I'll give you actually a good example of a case I'm working with right now. It's not even like resource guarding between dogs isn't even like the specific issue. Is they already have a 5-year-old pug, and they just brought home a new golden retriever puppy. The puppy is about 10 weeks old. My client the other night told me that they put out a licky mat. I'm not sure what kind of treat they put on the licky mat, but both dogs were licking from the mat. And then all of a sudden, the 10-week-old golden retriever growled at the older pug. And the pug backed off there. So this is new relationship, no bite history from a 10-week-old puppy. Okay. What's the prognosis here? Is this something that we can treat? You know, we can work on teaching the dogs to lick their licky mats together? Or would you say, you know what, this is probably just easier, we just separate them and keep them separate for this?
Yeah, so I think framing things in the perspective of helping the clients understand why the dogs might be doing that, because with puppies, it can be very shocking to some, both trainers and clients. They're like, whoa, this puppy is, you know, why at such a young age? It's almost like a toddler walking into a store with a machine gun for some clients. So we have to frame it in the perspective, right? A puppy growling at another dog over resources is pretty normal. It's pretty normal behavior. I mean, resource guarding, or to some level or extent, is how we've survived many, 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 many centuries. And same for dogs. If we were freely sharing our resources all the time, we wouldn't survive. So the puppies, you know, when I see that kind of behavior, it's typically fairly normal. Now, the caveat is, if we don't do anything, we can start to see that escalate. So if the puppy's saying, don't come near my licky mat because I really like this, and the pug was to say, no, you can't do that, this is my home, and sort of escalates, then we have problems. So the best thing to do in that case is just to mitigate any potential escalation of the behavior. So management, you know, two separate licky mats. And oftentimes that resolves the issue. Now, if you have a puppy that continues down the road of, okay, I'm guarding licky mats, but I also want this dog bed, and I also want the couch, and I'm also going to resource guard my owners, we've got to do more behavior change work there to mitigate that from escalating and to address that particular issue. So with puppies, it's a little different than, because there's not enough established history, right? If the golden retriever was 3 years old and has a history of guarding things for 2.5 years, now I have a pretty solid foundation of what I need to work on and where I can go from there without having to guess what the future is going to be like based from both the genetic standpoint and the learning standpoint. So puppies, the only difference I take is we're going to address this just like I would a 3-year-old dog, but keeping in mind this puppy is going to go through developmental stages, and we're going to have to monitor how much behavior change happens and how much genetics might be playing a role, and those kind of typical influences on behavior.
And how much do the individual personalities of the dogs, like, so for example, the pug, I asked my client, you know, what did Otto do, the pug? And she said, well, he just backed away. It was like he walked away. So when you do have that type of reaction from the dog that's on the receiving end of the aggression, does that, you know, help you feel like you worry a little less about that situation?
Definitely. That sounds like a wonderful conversation the two dogs had. Actually, just the puppy says, I don't want you near this. Pug's like, okay, you can have it. And that was it. Now, would I allow that to continue in a lot of different contexts? No, I would make sure there's management in place so that way the pug's not constantly being told off by this puppy, because that can actually escalate also. The pug's could be like, well, you can have that today, kid, but tomorrow, if you try that again with this other thing, I'm going to let you know that's not appropriate around here. So we don't want to see things escalate. So it gives us information when we see that and say, okay, there's a propensity for something to happen here with resources. So let's just manage resources, work with the dogs appropriately around resources to prevent escalation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So speaking about escalation, so how do you assess for the severity of a problem? You spoke about it a little before, the bite history. So could you go into a little bit more detail about that?
Sure. So, you know, the technical term that's used for this is prognosis, or the assessing the severity of a case and the overall potential outcome. I use actually 18 different variables to look at the factors in a case to determine, help the clients really determine just how severe a case they have. Because you get the same thing, I'm sure, Freddie, where the client's like, how bad is my dog? Is my, on a scale of 1 to 10, how bad is this? Do you think there's a hope for my dog? And you get all these real questions that are just sort of yes or no, black or white kind of answers, but it wouldn't be fair for me to just give them a very standard quick answer, because that wouldn't be fair for them or the dog. So I will educate the client on the factors that can make or impact this overall prognosis. And I mentioned the bite history. That's one of the most significant things I look at, is how severe have the bites been? Because dogs that are biting at a much higher level, causing greater injury to people or other dogs, is often less rosy for the prognosis because of the risk involved and the amount of management that's involved. So that often is the first thing I look at. Then I'll start to go through many of the other variables, including, again, I mentioned the size of the dog, the breed of the dog, the sex of the dog matters in intra-household dog-dog or dog-dog aggression cases in general. I will then move into other factors that could be impacting the behavior, such as health issues. So if the dog's got, and this is, of course, something you deal with in your practice at Behavior Vets, is underlying health issues that can impact behavior. So pain or endocrine issues, or, you know, those things that can impact behavior, we have to address those. So what that means is we have to address that first, but that could be more resources for the client. It could take more time to make sure we're addressing that issue. And we got to make sure that it is somewhat successfully resolved in a lot of cases, because if we don't address that underlying medical issue, then we're not going to address the behavior issue. And then I move through into management, how well the client can manage the environment or how manageable that environment is. So a poor prognosis case would be, you know, a dog that bites children, for instance, even at a low level. So let's say, you know, level 2 Dunbar scale bite, which is just a skin scrape, no deep punctures or anything like that, to children, but it's also biting children in the home, and they live in a home with 5 kids, and maybe they have lots of visiting children, or they live next to a school. You know, now we're adding a lot of complexity and severity to that case, because the risk is so high, the potential for another bite is very high in that kind of case. And moving through, go through the clients' resources themselves. Some clients have limited resources, and that includes time and finances, and ancillary resources such as veterinary behaviorists being in their area, right? Some areas of the country don't necessarily have access to that unless they're doing an online or remote consultation vet to vet. So, you know, it impacts the case. The success in the case can be impacted by, you know, how much time and money they have to spend on this particular issue with their dog. And it's going to vary with clients. I have some amazing clients that just, they expend so much time and resources on their dogs, really have just amazing commitment. And I understand some other clients may not be able to expend that kind of time and resources which can impact the overall prognosis. And one of the last things, and I didn't mention all the 18 different things, but one of the last, I'm kind of picking out the more important ones I focus on. But one of the most important aspects is the client's sort of emotional bank account, which mm-hmm. I got that term from Susan Freeman, the amazing Dr. Susan Freeman. And it's how much the client has left sort of in their tank to continue working with this issue. Because many clients have come to me and they've tried many things. They've seen other trainers. They've worked on this for a long time. And so they're starting to get spent. They're drained. That emotional comp can be running on fumes where they're feeling very distraught and not like they're going. The potential for them to put a lot of effort into this is often low. So part of being a good behavior consultant or trainer is helping them put some more deposits in, back into that emotional bank account to help them feel better about the case. So that's a lot of what I focus on initially is to give them hope and kind of remind them of why they got their dog in the first place and the nice moments they've had with their dog. And not to downplay the severity of the aggression in some cases, but we often have to help them feel better if we're going to see success in these cases by helping recharge their batteries a little bit. And you'll see like certain cases, you might have the tank is like running on fumes, like on E because the dog has bitten them or the dog has injured another dog in the home or the dog has injured somebody that they care deeply about, their spouse or their family members. So those are the cases I see where I'm often focusing heavily on just how much that client's emotional bank account is there or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is such an important part of this whole picture. I like to actually expand on that a little bit more, how we support the human caretakers in this equation here. Like an example, I had a case a couple of years ago with a family. They had three kids between 8 to 11 years. And both the parents were professionals with PhDs and both in their 40s. So really educated, very, very nice people. They had a Portuguese border dog who would exhibit aggression to dogs and strangers. Now the wife, when she was young, she was actually attacked by a dog. She was bitten. So she said several times to me that she is afraid of working with her dog in these situations because of the trauma she experienced. I try to understand that everybody has their own mountain to climb, so to speak. I would like to hear a little bit more of how you help clients who are struggling with taking that first step. You mentioned a little bit already, just reminding them of nice moments they've had with the dog. But this can be so hard. Like, how do we motivate our clients to work with our dogs and help them?
That's a really great question and an important point to discuss because we have to remember there's two sides of that leash, right? And the client often is experiencing a lot of emotions from this, and we have to be empathetic about that. If we're not going to be successful in our cases because if we're just focusing on the dog and changing the dog's behavior, we're missing a complete other side of the equation. So I think it's important to try to gain a sense of how that client's feeling during that initial consultation or initial time you're talking to them, while at the same time remaining empathetic, because everybody's got going through different things and has different experiences in life and then also with their dog and the situation they're experiencing there. So we have to really unpack and determine how that client's feeling. And you can ask questions that aren't too prying, but you can certainly bring that into discussion. How are you feeling about all of this? Is one of the questions I ask very consistently after discussing the overall prognosis and also giving them a understanding of why their dog's displaying that particular aggressive behavior. And when you do that, that's going to give you a lot of information about how you need to support the client. Some clients are like, I'm great. This is good. Feeling good. Let's do this. I'll follow whatever you say. So you're not worried too much about that. But then as you mentioned with your client, you have some clients that have experienced trauma in the past, and we have to navigate that. So it's this fine line of, human consulting or human therapy, which we shouldn't be walking on that line, but we should know when we need to refer to somebody. You know, Dr. Melanie Cerrone, who's gave a great webinar for me last year, is someone that works with the human aspect. She's also a brilliant dog trainer, but she helps the humans. She's a human psychology degree, and she came up with a great resource list for me with help for professional help for people experiencing trauma, both trainers experiencing compassion fatigue and trauma in their lives, and also clients who might be experiencing trauma from either having to choose behavioral euthanasia or who have been experienced real negative experiences with dogs. So that's important to have those resources just as much as we'd send a dog to a veterinary behaviorist. It's another resource we need to ensure we know about because that human aspect is so crucial to pay attention to because it can affect us, right? As trainers and behavior consultants, if we aren't recognizing that, we might blame ourselves. We might say, oh, it's something I said or something I'm doing wrong or my training strategy is not right. If we don't recognize, well, the clients, we might say, oh, this client's just not following through. The lack of compliance, we'll call it, right? We'll blame that on the client, but then we don't realize that. It's because this client might be deathly afraid of working with their dog or experiencing a barking, lunging dog out on the streets of the city, right? It's embarrassing or scary for them. So very important to assess that. Now, the things I do to help with those clients also is a lot of, if I'm sensing that, I'm going to do a lot of modeling myself, meaning if I can show them their dog being successful and they can see that, they're much more likely to try it themselves. So oftentimes, I will, if possible, it's not always possible, if possible, I will try to work with the dog first, establish some foundational skills, whether it be some hybrid day training scenario, or we move towards, you know, me just doing more sessions with the dog first before and the client watching me, just so they can see their dog being successful. And then you could take baby steps into getting the client to handle their own dog. And that might look like, let's say you've got a dog that's reacting on leash towards other dogs in the city or something. That might look like I'm holding the leash on one end, but the client also has another leash. So they just are kind of tandem walking with me. I'll say, I've got control of the dog, but I just want you to get experience of what it's like to walk with your dog on leash now without any issues. And then I'll start to have them work on the training and reinforcement aspect of it. And then I will gradually lengthen my leash and let them start taking control of the situation. And then, of course, setting all of our learners up for success, dogs and humans, is very important. So ensuring we pick the right environments to ensure everybody's successful is our job as trainers and consultants to really to make sure we're doing that. So find that a little bit of modeling, and you can get really creative with that too, right? Freddie, you can use like stuffed dogs. I use stuffed dogs with kids actually a lot, where they can practice certain things with a stuffed dog and then with their actual dog, so they get more comfortable with the actual techniques. They practice the mechanics. You can be the dog on the leash. So if the client's like, well, what do I do when he lunges? Or I'll be like, okay, I'll be the dog on the leash. I'm going to show you this technique and what you can do to center your balance. And you'll feel stronger if you use this particular leash handling technique in the rare event your dog should lunge. And then I will pull on the leash and just help them feel the mechanics of that. So there's lots of little things we can do for those clients that are feeling hesitant or they have some something that's sort of a speed bump along their journey that we can help them over. When we want to move things along in the right direction.
I love that when the stakes are high like that, because to some people in their mind, they're looking at this as they could be losing their dog. And so that's huge for them. And how you are able to break it down and help them out in those little steps, I think that's very, very helpful for our audience here who are, you know, many of them are trainers themselves. So really, thank you for that. That's some great advice there. I'd like to shift gears a little bit, but still on this topic, but looking at the aspect of the challenges that shelters and rescues face when they're assessing and placing dogs who exhibit aggression directed towards other dogs. So, you know, I train dogs at a shelter, the Humane Society of Westchester. And when we have a dog that is showing some aggression to other dogs, I'll try to work with that dog before they're adopted. But, you know, honestly, sometimes I feel like I'm putting in a ton of effort without knowing whether an adopter will continue with the plan. So, you know, am I wasting my time here? You know, how effective do you think behavior modification can be pre-adoption in helping these dogs be in place?
That's a really very interesting question for me, because I think, as they say, it depends. It depends on a number of variables that are coming to mind. And one of them is, what particular issue is the dog having? Because there's some aggression issues that translate well when you're working on it in a shelter or a rescue environment that will translate very easily to the new environment. Some of them might translate well without even doing anything, you know, resource guarding being one of them. We saw some of the studies coming out about dogs that resource guard in the shelter. It goes away in the home with no effort, no behavior change strategy at all. It's just moving the environment. So it depends on what the issue is. Some others, though, of course, might not change, you know, with just a change in the environment. So there should be some proactive training and behavior change strategies done in the shelter or rescue environment and then transferred to the owner. And then there's other issues that you might wait and just work with the owner. You're better off spending the time and resources saying, okay, we'll get this dog in an adoptive home because the shelter environment is just so stressful for them. We're not going to make any impactful change on the behavior. We'll just focus on enrichment and then making that dog stay as least stressful as possible. But when they go to their home, we're going to work with the owner there in that environment because it's going to be most impactful for our resources to be spent there. So that's one of the things I look at, is that the type of aggressive behavior it is or behavior issue you're seeing. And then you're also looking at the resources of the rescue or shelter. Having the fortunate experience of being able to travel around the world and seeing different shelter environments, different rescue experiences. And I really hope this message gets out there that everybody's trying their best, right? It really depends on the resources. And so you get a lot of snarky comments on social media and stuff when some shelters are maybe have a higher euthanasia rate, or they're doing certain things in their program that other shelters would be like, what are you doing? That's so bad. But it is so dependent on resources. And we know they're scarce when it comes to a lot of shelters. Some shelters are well-funded, or humane societies are well-funded, and some are not. And I've seen incredible extremes in the resources available. Some, like in my state, there's a shelter that has full board of directors, plenty of funding, nice shelter, and they might have one or two dogs at a time, maximum, like an entire system. And they have all these people and resources. And then I go to other places. I've seen a place where there's literally 2,000 dogs, all in this confined area with a staff of 7 people. So, we have to remember, everybody's doing the best they can with what they have. Nobody's saying, I'm just going to go in and do nothing, you know, and be lazy with these dogs. Everybody's trying the best. So to answer your question, going back to, you know, what affects these dogs in terms of what works best. And again, it depends on the resources, because you have some really nice, robust behavior programs out there in the shelters that they have the time, the knowledge, the resources to able to commit to the dogs in the shelter. And then others, you might say, well, it's better, we're limited on our behavior team here. Maybe it's better if we focus getting the dogs adopted and work with those clients once the dog is adopted. So I hope that answers that question.
Yeah, it's such a complicated issue, as you know, with your experience. So I'll give you an example. At my shelter right now, there is a pit bull mix that was found as a stray. She's probably about 50 to 60 pounds. She presented terribly in the kennel for the first few days. She was barking and lunging at the door at anybody who approached. But once she is out of the kennel, once she's actually in the free space, she's actually very friendly and playful with humans. She's an absolute doll, really, a real sweetheart. But what worries me is she has this intense and quiet focus on dogs. She's not barking, she's not lunging, but she pulls with all her weight, she's low to the ground, her head is down, and I'm using all my strength and leverage to keep her, to manage her, to keep her back. And really, like, I don't like what I see and how intense and focused she is. A dog could be over 40 yards away, and she is still exhibiting that same behavior. I took out one of those decoy dogs, okay, and she went up, sniffed the decoy dog from behind, and then slowly jumped on top of the dog and bit the dog's leg. You know, we're in our shelter, we're making life or death choices here, decisions here for a dog. And, you know, sometimes people think, why can't we just tell owners to avoid dogs and just adopt the dog into a only dog home and you don't bring the dog to a dog run? It's not as simple as that, but, what are the risks of adopting a dog like that out?
Yeah. So, that's one of the common arguments, like say, let's just find this dog an only dog home or an only dog kind of environment. The issue is there's a lot of dogs out there. And so there's almost always going to be an exposure to another dog at some point in the dog's life, whether it's going to the veterinary clinic or any other kind of emergency scenario where the dog's got to be around other dogs, or the dog maybe gets out of the home accidentally. This management can fail. And so, a good way to think about it, let's say we have this, we start to create the neighborhood of dogs that our only dog homes. We create, Wisteria Lane. All the dogs there go to Wisteria Lane. They all live there in that peaceful neighborhood. They just can't live with any of the dogs because all of them are dog aggressive. Are you going to be the one to move into that neighborhood with your dog if you have the opportunity to do so? So it's a good question to ask people. Like, will you feel comfortable if you're advocating for this, for all these dogs to just go to only dog home? Great, we'll do that. We'll create that neighborhood. But that neighborhood, it's got an open house, and are you going to go move there? So, so it's a good question. Do I want this dog living next to me? And some dogs are just inherently dangerous to other dogs. It's their risk of injury or death to other animals is significantly high with some dogs. That being said, those are rare examples, right? We don't see every dog being a heat-seeking missile like you're describing. I also did want to mention, too, on the assessments, because I know that's a hot topic and people might hear us talking about that. I kind of wanted to just address, like, how stuffed dogs, when we say decoy dog, we mean like stuffed dogs. And
yes,
sake of this conversation. And so stuffed dog assessments are a hot topic right now because some are saying that give a lot of false positives because the stuffed dog looks strange. And so you might see behaviors when we're doing that assessment that are not necessarily characteristic of what a dog might do to a real dog. And so it's always important to, you can gain some information from stuffed dog assessments, I think, in the sense of what some of the more overt behaviors will be, but we have to be careful because we can see some false positive, like the dog maybe grabbing the stuffed dog and like shaking it around. Sometimes the dog just figures out, oh, this is a stuffed toy, and it looks very similar to a grab, shake type of bite. So I always look to see if I can get other information because there's others in the industry right now that are saying, well, you can get accurate assessments from the stuffed dogs, and others are saying you cannot get accurate assessments. You get a lot of false positives. So I do like to ensure that we are seeing some other information before we make a final decision, whether it's doing a live dog greeting, how the dog responds to a live dog with protected contact. So the fence in between. But even then, you have to assess, wait, what is this barrier issues going on? So you never get a perfect answer, but I do like to, whenever possible, get a more robust assessment. Behavior history with previous owners, shelter staff that have worked with the dog, even veterinary visits, how did they go? And the dog saw the dogs. Get a lot of information. That's going to give you a more robust assessment to make that kind of decision. So, but yeah, there's some dogs that we really have to question the ethical side of the equation, whether it's safe or not to adopt that dog out.
Yeah, it is. That's a great point to make, that these are just single data points, and we're trying to collect as many data points as possible and then make an assessment based on our experience and our knowledge and of all the information we've gathered from the dog in different situations. It really is. It's never a straightforward answer, right?
All right.
So, I want to ask you very quickly about another topic that I think is very important in the training community in general. So if the audience could actually see us right now, they would actually see something that isn't very common in the dog training community. We are two Asian American men. We're talking about positive reinforcement training. I say that this is not very common because when I go to training events like workshops and seminars, I'm either the only one or one of the very few minorities in the room. So I would love to hear your thoughts about how we can help make training more accessible to minority communities and how we can increase diversity in the training community.
Yes, this is such an important topic because, as you mentioned, there just isn't a lot of diversity in the training dog training world. And, you know, it's I think one of the things that needs to happen is this open conversation that's happening now. And I'm really happy to see many of the big organizations also doing things for inclusivity and approaching that. So I think we're going to see a conversation open up more, and that's really important for our industry as a whole to discuss these things openly so we can kind of determine what is the issue here, what is causing this lack of diversity. I think there's several characteristics of it. I think just the information that, you know, dog training as a career in general, or how it gets disseminated to the younger generation has been lacking, right? You know, how do we get into dog training? Many of us, you know, we just stumble upon it, or we just don't. It's never like one of the things you see in a career fair or anything like that. So I think would be a good first step is just to expose that. It's a viable career working with animals, working with animal behavior, working with dog training. They're all, you know, viable, healthy careers with lots of growth, as we're seeing. There's lots of potential for growth in this industry, and it's continuing to grow, you know. Really just disseminating that information is the first step. And I think that can be done. And again, I love that the big organizations are all starting to take a role in this. I think it can be done by that because those organizations have the framework and the resources and the people that can help to do that, rather than some of us trainers individually trying to start that from scratch. We can certainly be part of that and be a voice in that. But I'm glad to see so much of that happening. And I think also part of it is cultural, meaning the cultural aspects of it. You, I'm sure, can agree, coming from the Asian American community, you know, dog training is not something most of us first generation, it's not something they're like, how it is. They've got you studying and playing musical instruments when you're like 3 years old. And my mom and dad certainly weren't saying, you're going to be a dog trainer when you get older. You know, it was like, you're going to university, you're going to be a doctor or a lawyer or something like that. So I think it's exactly. Cultural, right? And, you know, they look at dog ownership differently. I mean, it's a cultural aspect too. So, again, exposing it to those cultures is another big part of that. And I think, you know, folks like you and I can certainly help the Asian American community see that, but I think that's a big part of it as well. Would you agree?
Yes, I think it's trying to legitimize this profession, and that it's more than just a hobby. It's a real living, and it's not something that, you know, somebody can just, I'll watch some YouTube videos and I'll pick it up. It's something that requires a lot of study, continued study. You know, I'm always learning, and it's one of these things where you've heard this before. It's the more you learn, the less you realize that you know. When we're talking about training, so yeah, like even with my own family, like especially earlier on my career, it was, oh, it's so nice that you have a nice hobby, you know? Oh, and when you're going to get a real job? Yeah. But this is it. This is what I love. And yeah, I guess I'm lucky enough to that I can make a very comfortable living off of this. It really is. I think the more that we can show that this is something that is a legitimate profession for the different cultures who may not view it as, you know, a real profession. You know, they're looking as, yeah, when I went to school, it was like, you're becoming a doctor, right?
Yeah. It's definitely something that's deeply rooted in our cultures. I think another thing to think about too is we have to make it accessible. You know, we have to make this profession accessible to those that may not be able to afford the educational part of it. So I'm grateful to see again that many of the organizations and schools out there stepping up and offering scholarships and opportunities for those that might not be able to afford or even have access to these type of opportunities. So for anybody listening that's involved in those organizations or even as trainers ourselves, we can be welcoming to those that might be a minority or may not have the means to this type of education that we are able to experience. So open your doors up for that. And if you ask many minorities in the field, the common theme that's repeated is that you kind of go in with a little bit of a defensive shield at first because of your experiences, right? Your experiences growing up and depending on where you grew up in the community, your experience is going to differ. But it's always going to be helpful if somebody comes and welcomes that person. Just a quick hello, welcome, makes them feel part of that community. It can go such a long way. And that's how we can start to spread that like a spider web. We say, okay, you know, that person goes and tells their other friend who's a minority that I had a great experience at that seminar, workshop, dog trial, whatever it is, where you kind of go in with a little bit of, guard up at first, because that's the nature of what we've had to experience as minorities. So I think that can also be beneficial if somebody wants to do something, even just from an individual standpoint, not from a big organizational standpoint, just from the individual standpoint, just welcome that person in or provide opportunities, provide mentorship. You know, that's how we can really help to impact the industry as a whole.
Yeah. If everybody's doing a little bit of something, giving a little bit of their time, and if we can help just open up some eyes and help people realize that there are other opportunities. For example, just maybe volunteering with a shelter. If you're a trainer, volunteering with a shelter and offering your help to help adopters who can't afford training from a professional trainer, and perhaps like donating some of your time to help some of those adopters, especially adopters who are members of minority communities. You might open up some eyes and show people that, you know, this is something that I hope, you're not going to reach everybody, but sometimes you might get that one person who's like, wow, this is fun. This is actually something that was completely unexpected. I expected dog training to be much, I guess, harsher for the dog. And then we show them a way of how we can train dogs in a very elegant and gentle manner, in a way that really promotes that human-animal bond. I think that could be another way that individual trainers can go out and try to spread the word.
Absolutely. Yep.
Okay, so I would like to give you an opportunity here. Can you tell me a little bit about the stuff you are working on now and how people can learn from you?
All right. I've got a few projects in the works. So people can find me easily. The most quickest way is to go to aggressivedog.com. It's easy to remember. And that's where I have most of my events and seminars and conferences listed. The podcast is there as well, The Bitey End of the Dog. That will be already airing probably by the time of this release of this podcast. But The Bitey End of the Dog, I do a season usually starting in March and ending in the midsummer each year. I plan on doing that. So check that out if you have a chance. I've got the Aggression in Dogs Master Course that I run year round that you can find through my website, again, aggressivedog.com, as well as a number of expert webinars, which I bring in other trainers and well-known experienced folks in the industry to give webinars on the topics of aggression or something that's related to aggression in dogs. And of course, we've got the Aggression in Dogs conference happening in October that at the time of the recording of this, we're supposed to be doing it in Chicago, and we're hoping that's going to happen. It's going to be in person and with a live stream. So those that made it to last year's online conference will be able to do so again, or they might choose to go to Chicago, and we're hoping that happens. But if not, we're going to be doing something in some facet, whether it's online, in person, or hybrid. And that will be in October of this year.
Okay, that'd be great. I am hoping, looking forward, fingers crossed, we are able to do some in-person conferences later this year, really. All right, so before we wrap things up, what we're going to do is we're going to ask, there are three questions we're going to ask each of our guests, okay? So I just wanted to get a sense of, how much fun you have with your dogs, and you have what kind of pets do you have at home?
So I've got blended family pets. I have from my previous relationship, I have a yellow lab. She's 16 years old now, amazingly, and a little muggle Min Pin Pug mix. So, and she's getting up there in age too. And then with I currently have Castagna, who's a Chilean street dog that lives with me and my girlfriend Moira. So yeah, that's the run of my dogs right now. And Castagna is still young and active, so we do a lot of hiking with her and outdoor activities and enjoy. She's very well trained, but I don't take any credit for that. It's all Moira training her before she got here.
Okay. So, well, what's your favorite trick to teach and why?
Oh, that's a good question. I haven't taught my dog a trick in a long time, believe it or not. And I even joke it's been a long time since I taught a dog how to sit, because it's not something I even use that often in my life or with behavior modification. I think if it's coming to tricks, I like to teach dogs to, I wouldn't even know if it's called a trick, but this start button behaviors, which I'll give Leslie McDevitt credit for that, is where the dog is engaging in some behavior to say, I'm ready to move forward in this next step. So it's a way teaching a dog part of a conversation that we can recognize to say, okay, they want to do something, rather than, and I'm talking differently than like pawing at us or nudging us our hand when they want to be pet. It's more like, I want to proceed with this particular procedure that normally I would have issues with, like clipping nails or ear cleaning. Start buttons are great for that because it opens the line of communication up between the person and the dog.
Yeah, love start button behaviors. So how do you have fun with your dogs?
Oh, so Castagna loves to play fetch. She's so fast. We actually thought she was greyhound or some sort of, sighthound mix, because she's so fast. We just got her DNA test done, and she's boxer and German shepherd and Belgian turf and a couple other breeds, but she's incredibly fast. And I love playing fetch with her and going on hikes, because that's just such a wonderful sight to see her run, and just how much faster she is than other dogs. And I don't say that to brag, but if her ball is launched, she will outrun any other dog trying to get that same ball.
I love watching dogs run. I'm right with you. Oh, great. And last question is, what gives you hope for the future of animal welfare?
Oh, I love that. The impact of how information is spreading now is beneficial for dogs and overall positive reinforcement-based training, because information is spreading very quickly now. So with social media and the younger generation using things like TikTok and Instagram and all these ways of spreading information, I think it's going to be very beneficial for dogs and animals in the long run, because they're soaking up this information, whereas before it was much slower to drip out there. Now, there's, of course, we could argue the opposite side of the coin. There's some harmful information getting out there with this quick spread. But I think, as positive reinforcement trainers that are listening, I know there's many of you out there that also have your social media channels and are doing great work. So continue to do so, because you're shifting that tide in a very healthy direction. And I see it impacting, you know, in the last almost two decades of training now, I'm seeing just how fast it's spreading and how much it's going to have an impact on dogs and animals in general, but overall from a welfare and training perspective.
Yeah, I agree with you. I want to believe in the goodness of people, that they are going to choose to be more gentle and have more fun with the dogs. Okay, Michael, this is great. Thank you so much for your time and joining us. We really appreciate it, and we look forward to learning more from you and more of your adventures, hearing about more of your adventures in the world.
Okay. Thanks, Freddie. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Hey, animal lovers. Thank you for joining us. If you enjoyed what you heard and like to learn more, please follow us on Facebook or visit www.behaviorvet.com. We have much more cool stuff for you if you'd like to keep geeking out on companion animal behavior with the Behavior Vets team. Come back soon and join us on our journey to make life better for the animals in your life. Thanks again for listening. Remember to have hope, because real change is possible, and we can achieve it together. Enjoy our podcast, but this is a reminder that the contents of this podcast are for educational and entertainment purposes only. The comments and advice are never intended to be a substitute for seeing a behavior professional or a credentialed veterinarian in person. While the content is always intended to help people receive the best possible behavior support for their pets, any information you utilize from this podcast is at your own risk.